Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've your orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal tokens, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. Put your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's July the 19th, 2018. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Tell you what, let's kick it off this week with a young man who is planning his migration. His name is Rico.
Hello. My name is Rico, and I'm a future Northwest migrant. I'm currently in the process of coming home. In my case, it'll be a literal homecoming. I grew up a few miles from where the party's headquartered, but like most people my generation, failed to launch when it was appropriate to do so, and so I got dragged down to Texas with my family when I was 19. If I had known about the Northwest Front back then, I never would have left. But I didn't, so I did, and now I have to get myself prepared to return to where I started. A few years back, I lost a decent-paying job here in Texas for what was essentially being a racially conscious white male in a land of diversity and neocons. Afterward, I decided there was no point in staying in Texas and dealing with the hordes of shitskins. I sure as shit wasn't going to try to start a family in this cesspit. I decided going back to the Pacific Northwest was my only option. The question was where. I grew up in Western Washington, so I didn't need to scout that region out. I refused to live in a place where people can't pump their own gas, so Oregon was out. How about Montana? I'd heard good things about Montana. A month or so later, I made a scouting trip to Kalispell, Montana, where some stormfront users had attempted to build a pioneer little Europe. Being back in the Northwest again, even if only for a few days, was refreshing. Everything was clean. All the signs were in English. Graffiti was nowhere to be found. White people walked around town without a hint of fear. In fact, the only non-white face I saw the entire time I was there was a mulatto girl working at the Burger King across the street from my motel. Unfortunately, there was one other thing missing in Kalispell. Jobs. The Flathead Valley is a fine place to settle, but it only really works if you already have money when you get there, like Richard Spencer's family. One of the major problems I see with a lot of people who are interested in the Butler Plan, so they have this idea that they can just pack up and go off into the woods in Montana or Idaho and just plop down and get a good job and support a family. That's simply not the case. I've lived in isolated towns and rural areas, and there's really nothing in them as far as jobs go. That's why in the past, people did things like joining the army or taking a one-way bus to Hollywood to get out of them. They knew they had no future beyond working at a cash register or a gas pump in those small towns. You're not going to be able to settle in a place like that and support a family, assuming you can even support yourself, especially if all your skills are white-collar or something in food service or retail. It quickly became apparent that if you want to successfully migrate, you're going to need to go to where the jobs are, as in the metro areas, and have a trade that's actually relevant to the region. I used to be involved with security and corrections, but nigger wrangling isn't exactly something there's a lot of demand for in the homeland, so I'm currently training to be an auto mechanic. After all, new males who wear their sister's pants and drink soy can't even change their own oil, never mind replace brakes or a timing belt. The rest of you need to be picking up a useful trade as well. Like the old man always says, if we're going to have gainful employment in the current year, we need to have the skills to fix rich people's toys. There's a major shortage of workers in the skilled trades, and that shortage is going to get even greater once people who got into them decades ago start retiring. Skilled mechanics, plumbers, electricians, truckers, and welders are always in demand and can practically walk into a shop and walk out with a job. There's no need to worry about being replaced by some street shooter with an H-1B or a spick who will work under the table for half of what you need to survive. In addition to having the required job skills to support yourself, you need to pick the right area to migrate to. Heading off into the woods in Idaho sounds appealing to a lot of people, but not only is it not all that viable, especially for outsiders, but it's not all that helpful either. If you've been listening to Radio Free Northwest for more than a few weeks, you'd know that Harold has been begging for, above all else, Class A people who are actually willing to help the party get the ball rolling. You need to actually be near the party to do that, and the party's headquartered in the Seattle metro area, not in the woods. If you want the Northwest homeland to become reality, you're going to have to suck it up and live near the cities and the liberals, and actually put some effort into making it reality. Nobody's going to do it for you. Godot isn't coming unless we ourselves become Godot. Besides, going off in a woods to hide from Zog and diversity doesn't work anyway. Ask Randy Weaver. He tried to hide from Zog in a woods, but Zog found him and his family anyway. To successfully migrate, not only do you need to have the right job skills and physical location, but you need to have the resources to survive when you finally come home. That means a few thousand dollars to keep a roof over your head while you try to find a place to stay and a job. I've got enough money in my wallet to drive back to Washington right now. But once I get there, I'd be pretty much shit out of luck, because neither Harold, Andy, nor the trucker are going to let me sleep on their couch. This isn't the 1960s, and Northwest Front isn't Commander Rockwell's American Nazi Party. There's no flop house for t-shirt youth. You have to stand on your own 2 feet now. One of the key criteria for becoming a Class A individual is being able to not only physically migrate, but do so using your own resources. The party isn't yet at the point where it can hold your hand when you migrate, and probably won't get to that point anytime soon. To that end, I bought an RV last year and am currently in the process of getting it ready for a cross-country trip. That way I'll have a place to stay and all my stuff with me when I come home and won't have to bother finding a motel or an apartment, dealing with a moving truck, or unpacking. RV parks are also an extremely cheap place to live, which is absolutely critical in a place like the Seattle area, where housing is more often than not absurdly expensive. RV parks also tend to be not very welcoming to diversity, so that's nice too. I'm not suggesting everyone should go that route, but it's at least something to think about if you have somewhat limited resources. Saving on rent by living in an RV while you save money for homecoming will also help accelerate the homecoming process. I hope I didn't ramble too much. I'm not quite old enough to become Grandpa Simpson just yet. Hope I'll see you guys in the homeland soon. Thanks for listening.
Okay, I was going to talk about my account being suspended at Twitter, but Rico mentioned the t-shirt youth just now, and I've been meaning to have a word in your shell-like ears about them, so I guess this would be a good time for me to do that. I'll get into my Twitter thing later on in the show. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar with what we're talking about, the term t-shirt youth refers to a phenomenon that I noticed when I first came into the movement some time ago, and so this is not just an internet-related thing. They've always been around. It's also a generally recognized phenomenon in the world as a whole. I remember reading a State Department document some years ago where some career diplomat and egghead type stated that the worst and most urgent sign of serious trouble coming on in any country is large numbers of unemployed young men hanging around on street corners with nothing to do except listen to troublemakers whispering in their ear. Nowadays, of course, the huge number of underutilized and throwaway white youth that political correctness produces don't hang out on street corners as a rule. They hang out electronically on Reddit or one of the chans in mom's basement, but the principle is the same. For several generations now, American and Canadian political correctness in all its multifarious forms has produced a growing number of rootless young white men from broken families, more and more of them single-parent families, mostly headed by women. Yeah, we're catching up with the niggers on that. With the blacks, it's because the father runs away or goes to prison. With whites, it's usually because the mother drives the father away through her behavior or by abusing the pro-feminist courts and law to force him to flee from the home while still extorting money from him. The t-shirt youth are rootless and restless young white men with nothing but the t-shirts on their backs. They are victims of political correctness, although I don't deny that many of them are slackers and fuck-ups who are also responsible themselves for a lot of their own problems. Now, this again is not completely their fault, since, as they used to say back in the day, nobody ever taught them how to act. But I think it's at least somewhat reasonable to expect young Aryan men with the greatest genetic heritage in the world to teach themselves how to act, at least to some degree. There are some things that young white men and women should know instinctively because it's programmed into their chromosomes. These guys spend their youth moving from parental basement to crashing on a string of couches to cheap furnished apartments in old houses, and sometimes down to the Salvation Army shelters and the streets. I think those of us who have been playing tag with this kind of thing for some years know there is a line in this society below which you can't fall, because if you do, you never get back up. These young white men, who as the years go by are no longer quite so young, are either unemployed or marginally employed at best. There is a lot of painful truth to the stereotype of the white boy carrying $50,000 in student loan debt for his useless degree, who's delivering pizzas or stocking shelves on the midnight shift at Safeway in his 30s.
You know my heart keeps telling me you're not a kid at 33.
These young white men are in many cases overeducated and overqualified for the marginal employment that they do have access to, which was always my problem. They've been effectively cast out from mainstream society, sometimes from a very young age, and sometimes after a few years of menial employment. Then when they turn 40, the age discrimination kicks in. Combine age, skin color, gender, and a sketchy track record, it all renders them virtually unemployable for the rest of their lives. Especially in this increasingly technical age where within a few years, millions of low-level jobs that are now being done by people will be getting done by robots and AI. Now, some of these white boys develop substance abuse problems with booze or grass or opioids, prescription painkillers, that kind of thing. I've noticed that many of them are actually thrown out of the house like I was. But in these days of growing totalitarianism and forced conformity of thought, it's more and more for overt racial utterances or activities, which usually means something like wearing a MAGA hat at the dinner table or using a forbidden word on Facebook. And for various reasons, these kids can't or won't use the military as a safety net like I did. Of course, most of the military services won't accept young recruits anymore without a thorough vetting that includes all of their social media. And if they've said anything even remotely politically incorrect on Twitter or Facebook, kid can't go into the Army or the Navy or whatever. They picked up a traceable political or racial footprint in high school that bars them from enlistment, possibly for supporting Donald Trump for president. And that's going to stick with them if something doesn't change. Keeping these young men on a kind of lifelong blacklist for something that they posted on social media or a legal public event that they attended when they were age 17. The coming revenge presidency of Kamala Harris certainly won't enhance their chances. The political blacklist is even now hardening into something that's going to be lifelong and permanent if we don't change things. Now, if you'll pardon the ramble, I get where these guys are coming from. Now, I myself was never a total drunk, and I never quite hit that low a level, although I came close a couple of times. I mention all this so all of you guys out there who are listening to this who are living on the T-shirt youth level will know that I do indeed understand, and I appreciate your desire for vindication. It's totally morally justified. Now, what used to happen to me all the time back in the 80s and 90s was I would get some temp job at a big corporation, basically shuffling papers or tapping on a keyboard, kind of a cube dweller type thing, and my supervisors would explain to me with various degrees of diplomatic circumlocution that they were over the moon about my old-fashioned work ethic that I learned back in the day and my overall performance, and they really wanted to keep me, and I had a job there as long as I wanted one, but it would be a long, long time before I was hired on permanently, if ever, and before I got any benefits, if at all. And I would never be promoted. I was being offered 25 years in the same cubicle, and the people in charge, mostly women, were honest with me about that. No tits, no future. One big multinational that I temped for over a year flat out admitted that they had a quota hiring system for white males, and that was in the early 1990s. I can imagine what it's like today. This is what cartoonist Scott Adams refers to as the diversity ceiling. Now, I can't count the corporate jobs I had as a temp, which I left after 6 months or a year when I saw the women and in some cases the various dark-skinned types shooting ahead of me. I might add, lest we forget, that a lot of the white women on these jobs weren't too happy with the situation either. You see, a black or other non-white female is an affirmative action twofer, and corporations love them to death. And I'm rambling again, aren't I? Where was I? Oh, yes, the T-shirt youth. Now, what these men are, if the party can ever work its way up to a sufficiently professionalized level to make proper use of them, is a pool of potential revolutionaries and activists, although obviously if that's going to happen, there will have to be a few more people other than Harold Covington getting involved in all this. I said a pool of potential personnel, not a ready-made in VA. And I'm aware that in many cases these guys are problematic. They have picked up a number of bad habits or acquired skeletons in their closets, and we're going to have to do a lot of sorting. Now, one of the reasons that we need to professionalize our party is so that we will have a procedure and a protocol for vetting and training and bringing on board these T-shirt youth of all ages. We need to make use of this tremendous reserve of human resource that lies buried within that mountain of flabby, rootless, and torpid flesh. In a professionalized party, we will need what the communists call cadres, but not every individual is going to be suited for that. And don't worry, I know that, and I know that there will have to be a continual winnowing of the chaff, so to speak. But those who do make the grade will have a number of advantages, not the least their very poverty and disorderly past lives from hand to mouth. Now, there is a saying that he who has a family gives hostages to fortune. Our Northwest Front Corps actives can afford no hostages to fortune. I know one of the things that a lot of our groups and spokespeople often emphasize is white people's duty to marry and have children, and that's vitally important. Yes, no argument. But let's face it, once you've got your first baby in that crib, suddenly it becomes really, really important to keep that job down at the plant, and you're not going to do anything to jeopardize it, like getting involved with us. And I get that. Look, this is something that we're going to have to get into later in some detail when the professionalization process finally begins. But the fact is that when the time comes for the party to start hiring, we're going to need young, physically fit men with no ties, no hostages to fortune, no loose ends that can be pulled on to make them unravel. I'm just saying, those we will have in abundance. This is Ian Stewart with kind of the ultimate T-shirt youth song. We'll be right back.
you trying to mess us up now, trying to make us quit. If that's what you're trying to do, you boy, not achieving it.
Hi guys, we've got the trucker coming up for his weekly installment, but before we let him get on with it, I just want to explain a couple of things to you guys about the trucker and the way he operates, in case you notice something a little bit odd in this one. He records these snippets or whatever on his phone, and he sends them to me. I think he has some kind of limit on his phone or his portable computer in his truck or whatever he's got, such that he can only send me about 4 to 5 minutes max. So anyway, he sends me these short little clips and I have to patch them together. And frankly, sometimes I make a mistake and I put something out of sequence, or else, as this happened this week, I just seem to lose one of his little audio files on my hard drive and I forget about it for a while and then I find it. And so that's why one of the segments in this particular show from the trucker is going to seem to be out of order. Because it is, because I think basically I just lost it. Anyway, so if the trucker's submissions seem to have kind of a rough edge to it at times, that's why. It's mostly me just getting them mixed up here on this end, something like that. I will say this, that the reactions I get seem to indicate that the trucker, who has been on here for some years now, is one of the most popular features on Radio Free Northwest. His rather gravelly voice has become well known all throughout the white nationalist movement. And yeah, for obvious reasons, I'm not going to compromise his identity. He doesn't have any websites of his own or anything like that. But he does get well-wishing emails that I occasionally pass on to him. And by the way, the same goes not just for the trucker, but for Gretchen or any other guest we have on here on the show. I don't publish our contributors' emails or anything like that, but if you want to send me a fan letter or something for Gretchen or the trucker or Andy, of course Andy publishes his own email address, but anyway, you get the idea. I will be happy to forward anything you have to say, anything by way of comments or anything, to any of our contributors. And that's enough of me babbling, so let's get on with it.
Westbound and down, 18-wheels rolling. Are we going to do what they say can be done? We've got a long way to go, and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. If you put hard on the pedal, son, never mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got to run the base.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Johnson Village, Colorado. You'll have a hell of a time trying to find this one on your map. Now it's South Denver, little west of it, on US 285. But anyway, this is for those of you that are going to be preparing to make your migration. Well, it's getting a little late in the year for actually doing your migration. I did some fact checking in the library for you, and it'll take you about 4 to 6 months to get here from the Chicago area. Your oxen can only go at a walking pace. You'll be able to cover approximately 15 miles a day, so it'll take about, like I say, 4 to 6 months to get out here. They'll haul about 2,500 pounds worth of gear per pair of oxen, I think it is. So if you've got a lot of crap, you're going to need either more wagons or more oxen or both. So I suggest whittling your belongings down to something your team of oxen can actually pull easily so you don't overtax them. And to get here to the Northwest, you'll have two options. You have the Oregon Trail, which basically goes across, as it starting off at Chicago. Oh, and just a hint, you may want to upgrade your wagon and especially your canvas cover to the Kevlar cover or Kevlar impregnated canvas with ballistic siding and stuff going through the Chicago area. That way you don't have to worry about getting shot full of holes as you pass through the Chicago area. You'll have reasonably adequate water till you get over to Wyoming. Once you hit Wyoming, water gets a little harder to find. You also have to watch out for those. There's some really vicious beasts in Wyoming. They're really murderous creatures. They play hell on people and wagon trains and anybody going across that barren state. They're called jackalopes. Oh man, the death toll from them things is just unbelievable. So be prepared to fight off the jackalope birds. Once you get over into Wyoming, that's where the trails split, and you can either take the Bozeman Trail that goes up through Montana, or you can continue across on the Oregon Trail, which follows the Mormon Trail, across into Utah, and then bends up into Idaho, and then finally ends up in Oregon. So, I hope that this little bit of information is helpful. So, you can start your planning this year, so you can get all your ducks in a row, so you can start once the snow starts to melt off next year. And, like I say, it'll be about 4 to 6 months to get across from the Chicago area. That is if you live through making it through the Chicago area. All right, well, I hope to see you out there on the trail, making your scouting trips and your migration soon. Have a good one, comrades. This is the Trucker signing off from Colorado. Greetings, comrades. This is the Trucker coming at you from Vega, Texas. I'm up here in the Panhandle. I loaded this morning over in Colorado, the load going over to North Carolina, and I was doing a little nostalgia trip about back when I was a wee little crumb cruncher, and parents going on vacation, comparing it to my trip today over to North Carolina. And, yeah, they had it so much easier back then. Back then, we had it was about 12, 13, I guess it was, and we got rid of our, I forget what year it was, Falcon station wagon for a 1968 Ford Econoline van. I'll learn how to drive in that van also, but neither here nor there. Anyway, way back when, my parents had to do research for their trip. You know, they went to the library and got different travel magazines and encyclopedias to figure out where they wanted to go. Then they sent their itinerary into AAA, which they were members of, and a few weeks later, they got this nice step-by-step trip back in a nice bound book with strip maps, exactly the route they were taking and where they were stopping and how long it should take and all that. It was really detailed and oh so nice compared to nowadays when you just whip out your smartphone, download an app, and put all the information into it. You can do all the research right from your smartphone or your tablet, which I'm working off of. But anyway, like the company had to be routed across US 160, which is, I was loading west of I-25 south of Denver by a couple hundred miles. But anyway, and the route they had me going on was closed. Back in my parents' day, they wouldn't know it until they got there. But here, I could just have downloaded the Colorado Roads app onto my tablet, and lo and behold, holy crap, a choosies, the road was closed. So I just went and rerouted and went down US 285 into New Mexico through Santa Fe and am now on I-40 where I'm supposed to be. So, yeah, my parents had it so much easier back in the day with doing the strip maps and not knowing about any road closures or accidents or anything like that coming up ahead. We because they didn't have these neat, nifty apps, those troublesome apps that we have now. You have so much information at your fingertips nowadays compared to way back when. What's that got to do with anything? Well, hey, vacation is kind of like making a scouting trip, and so much easier back in the day rather than having everything smartphone like we do nowadays. You know, it's, anyway. So, get off your lazy asses, break out your smartphone, download a couple of apps, and be on your way out to the homeland. Should be. Okay, well, this is the trucker signing off from the panhandle of great state and Republic of Texas. Not that I like it much down here right now, because when I parked this afternoon, it was 100 damn degrees here. I'd much rather be up in the homeland where it's cooler with a nice marine breeze blowing through my backyard. Okay, well, this is the trucker signing off from Texas.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Lake Station, Indiana. I'm on a run from over in Maryland, somewhere where I didn't want to go, but oh well, that's my job. To the homeland, I gotta deliver in Clackamas, Oregon next week. So anyway, I ended up spending my 4th of July day, had to do a delivery down in North Carolina at a Walmart distribution center, and loaded yesterday on the 5th in Jessup, Maryland. What a waste of a place that is. I mean, pardon my French, but what a shithole. I ended up spending my afternoon and evening in a rest area just south of there because I didn't feel like putting up with the truck stop, having to pay, what is it, about 12 or 15 or no, I think it's probably closer to 20 bucks now for parking overnight there. So I just hung out in the freebie rest area. No idea if they provide security there, but I provide my own. Sorry, Maryland, but I don't give a shit what your laws are. I had my little friends with me, and if somebody tried to break into my truck, yeah. Anyway, I'm not advocating for y'all to break the law, but my name is not Reginald Denny, and I'm not going to have some shit-skinned individual bust into my truck and go and beat me within an inch of my life. No, I'll go and ventilate his ass. But that's just me. Anyway. So, I was just on the internet here a few minutes ago, and surprising and shocking of all things, nobody got shot, nobody got killed in Chicago due to gunfire over the 4th of July day, from Wednesday morning to Thursday morning. 7 people did get shot, 2 of them were teens, but, either they're not that good of a shot, or, I don't know, whatever. So, for those of you coming through the Chicago area, try to stay on the interstate. Don't go through the downtown, as we call the Batcave area and stuff. Spend the extra money. Stay on the toll road. Stay out of the war zone down there, out of Niggerville, or however the hell you want to put it. But yeah, it's not worth it trying to save a couple of bucks going through that area. If you want, go. I usually go and myself take the 294 around to the 290 or back up to 90, whichever, and do it that way. Or if you want to go and avoid the majority of the tolls, I mean, you'll end up having to pay one small toll of a couple of bucks, maybe, I guess it is. You can go and do I-80 and then run that over to I-39 and run that north, and that way you avoid the majority of the I-90 tolls and stuff. You'll have a couple more, one more toll up there at the north end before you hit Wisconsin and Freedom and stuff. But anyway, well, that's just letting you know about a little bit of routing and all that around the war zone called Chicago. Okay, well, this is the trucker signing off from Indiana. Hope to see you out there on the road making your scouting trip, or better yet, your migration to the homeland soon. So, have a good one, comrades, and keep it between the ditches.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Middletown, Montana, again. I was here earlier this week for my mandatory 10-hour break and a fuel stop, and I'm back here again, just getting done with my 10-hour break again. I'm going to be getting fuel this morning, but this is for those of you that are really interested in migrating out here. Weather report. Well, when I was here last, earlier this week, it was overcast and rainy. It's still overcast and misting right now. At that point in time, it was getting up into the mid-70s during the daytime and dropping down into the mid-50s at night. And it's the same right now today on Friday, June 22nd. So, over there in the homeland, I got to do my delivery, and then yesterday on Thursday, reload there in Everett, Washington, and it was getting up into the upper 70s, lower 80s over there, and dropping down into the, I think, about the mid-60s at night. So it's getting a little warm in the daytime. The humidity was probably in the 50-ish percent range, so forgot to look to see what it was here, but I can do that real quick. And, oh my, the humidity here is 93%, but yeah, that's probably because it's raining or misting or whatever. So, anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out there for those of you that are wondering what the weather's like kind of right now out here. It varies a bit, but over there and coming after I got over the hill, but before I crossed the Columbia River yesterday, on the west side of the Columbia River, north of I-90, there was a brush fire going on. I'm not sure exactly how big it was, but they had a little bit of a wildfire going there. It looked like it had climbed up the side of the hills there and was a couple miles inland by that point in time. A couple of good columns of smoke coming up from it, but yeah, it gets dry over in eastern Washington. You got to watch your campfires and stuff. I'm not sure what caused it, but yeah, it gets kind of dry on, even though there's a lot of water going through the river, they don't irrigate that section of land. So it gets a lot of moisture during the wintertime, and the tumbleweeds and sagebrush and all that kind of crap grows. And then when the summer hits, it dries out. And if you don't watch where you throw your butts or where do the sparks go from your campfire, well, you can end up setting part of the state on fire. So, I haven't seen any wildfires or forest fires here in Montana yet this year. Like I say, it's kind of damp for that right now at this point in time. But anyways, well, this is an update from the eastern section of the homeland, just down the hill from where Ted Kaczynski used to live and where they caught him up there in Lincoln, Montana, about an hour or so east of here on Montana 200. If any of you history buffs wanted to know kind of where I was at and where they caught him at. So, anyway, all right, this is the Trucker signing off from Montana. Hope to see you out there on the road making your scouting trips and your migration soon. Have a good one, comrades.
We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch old bandit run.
This is a supporter of ours who uses the name Metatronic.
It's true that white Americans have continuously ceded ground to non-whites since the end of the Civil War, as what's popularly become known as white flight. And many pro-white activists view white separatism in a similar light. No more white flight, they exclaim. We need to take it all back, they demand. This is a healthy emotional reaction to the prospect of losing our traditional territories. But this is also why it's the wrong attitude to take. It's primarily rooted in feelings and emotions rather than intellect. To dissect this further and understand why white separatism isn't white flight, let's give closer consideration to why white flight has become such a substantial phenomenon in the first place, and conclude with a proper definition of white separatism. Why do whites flee? Because the majority refuse to stand and fight, even with overwhelming superior numbers, in a neighborhood, city, or region, and even in areas where consciously pro-white attitudes are prevalent. The Klan reached the apex of its power and influence during a time when many whites saw nothing wrong with segregation, for example. Yet, the Klan found out that the majority of whites were also unwilling to do what's necessary to hold on to it. when what's necessary means spilling blood and having their own blood spilled, potentially, as well as risk incarceration in the process, there is and always has been only 3% or less willing to do so. It's simply a fact of human nature that no matter how dire circumstances become, majority of any given population will flee rather than engage in conflict, regardless if it's direct or indirect. This is why societies have traditionally had a separate warrior class, and why revolutionaries are few but effective under correct circumstances. So those who exclaim and implore that whites must stand their ground are ignorant of human nature. Whites won't rise up en masse. They never have and never will. Hence, white flight. That said, whites will support and stand behind a vanguard that's willing to fight. Which brings us back to the example of the Klan. There were many whites who never put on the robes of the Klan, but who wholeheartedly supported the organization, including financially. But despite this fact, the Klan still essentially lost their struggle to hold on. When the government forced integration at gunpoint, it was game over, and we've been living with the consequences ever since. Which brings us to another important reason for white flight. The system. Pro-white activists who insist that we hold our ground and or take it all back also don't understand who the enemy is fundamentally, nor do they understand the nature of the battlefield. They think we're fighting on even ground when we're actually fighting in an entirely uphill battle against an extremely fortified adversary. Virtually speaking, we've been kicked out of the fort. The only whites allowed in are civic nationalists and liberals. That New World Order bastion on top of the hill is the system. In ancient times, our warrior ancestors would never be so stupid as to charge the hill head on. It would amount to a futile suicide mission. Instead, they'd lay siege to the fort, which itself requires a secure camp outside the enemy stronghold from which to conduct siege operations. White separatism is that siege camp. It's a means of consolidating our warriors and focusing support on the task at hand. From the separatist camp, we lay siege to the enemy's strongholds until he retreats, not the other way around. Then we take control of the fort, and from that position of strength, look towards the next enemy hill, and then the next, and then the next. While behind us, we've already accomplished our mission, liberated sovereign territory to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children.
Yeah, the revolution starts now. Yeah.
You know, I occasionally make facetious references on this show about my going senile and having Alzheimer's and mad cow disease, etc., etc. Not really so funny. I found this on my hard drive. I have no idea where it came from. I have no idea if I've broadcast it on this show yet. And so here it is.
I've been thinking a lot about a phrase I've been hearing. That anti-racist is just a code word for anti-white.
It's starting to make sense. They say that they're anti-racist, but what they really are is anti-white.
Think about it.
Nobody says that a black neighborhood needs more diversity.
Nobody says that an Asian neighborhood needs diversity.
White neighborhoods and only white neighborhoods are said to need more diversity.
Nobody says that a black church needs more diversity.
Nobody says that Asian churches need more diversity.
White churches and only white churches need more diversity.
Black pride is seen as good and healthy and normal. Asian pride is seen as good, healthy, and normal.
But if I show pride in my race, the white race, I'm said to be a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews.
If a black woman wants to date inside her race, that's acceptable. If an Asian woman wants to date inside her race, that's acceptable.
But if I want to date and marry within my race, the white race, I'm called the R word.
Black politicians are openly admitting that they are working towards the best interests of their people. Hispanic politicians are openly admitting that they are working towards the best interests of their people.
If a white politician were to openly admit that they were working in the best interest of their people, there would be a national scandal, a public outcry, and would be kicked out of office.
Throughout elementary school, junior high school, and college, I was told that my race, the white race, was the cause of all the world's problems. Now, many of you had jobs where minorities say things that would get you, as a white person, instantly fired.
This conditioning is done to white people, and only white people. White children, and only white children, are being affected by this, and only white countries are doing this.
The Aztecs conquered many surrounding Native American tribes,
practiced human sacrifice and held slaves.
Yet anti-racist don't say that Mexicans must apologize forever and have their lands forcibly flooded with non-Mexicans and be forced to assimilate.
The Ottoman Empire attacked white Slavs and took many of them as slaves, so much that we get the word slave from the Slavs.
Yet anti-racists don't say that the Turks must apologize forever and have their lands flooded with non-Turks.
World history is a rainbow of violence.
Yet all whites and only whites are demonized for this violence. Anti-racism is the code word for anti-white. Resist this conditioning by using this mantra.
Africa for the Africans. Asia for the Asians. White countries for everyone.
Everybody says that there's this race problem. Everybody says that this race problem will only be solved when the third world pours into white countries and only white countries.
The Netherlands and Belgium are just as crowded as Japan and Taiwan, but nobody says that Japan and Taiwan will solve this race problem by bringing in millions of third worlders and, quote, assimilating, unquote, with them.
Everybody says that the final solution to this race problem is for every white country and only white country to assimilate, i.e. intermarry with all those non-whites.
What if I said that there was this race problem? And that this race problem would only be solved if millions of non-blacks were brought into every black country and only black countries?
How long would it take anyone to realize I'm not talking about a race problem? I'm talking about the final solution to the black problem.
And how long would it take any sane black man to notice this? And what kind of psycho black man wouldn't object to this?
But if I tell the obvious truth about the ongoing program of genocide against my race, the white race,
the obvious truth about the ongoing program of genocide against my race,
the ongoing program of genocide against my race, the white race,
but if I tell the obvious truth about the ongoing program of genocide against my race, the white race, liberals and respectable conservatives agree that I'm a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews.
They say they are anti-racist, but what they are is anti-white.
Anti-racist is a code word for anti-white.
Right, as I mentioned earlier on this show, last Monday, my Twitter account, which I've had since January of 2016, was permanently suspended. I'm not completely sure why. They did cite one particular tweet I made, but it doesn't make any sense, which seems to be about par for the course with Twitter. At the time I was sent to the Phantom Zone, I had 1,727 followers, which for 30 months on Twitter was chicken feed. I had a small stable of maybe 50 followers who actually ever responded to my tweets. I would say maybe 100 to 120 followers on there that I knew for a fact through various sources to be legitimate, actual white nationalist people, and the rest of them were all silent, either secret police spies or NGO spies, or cognitive dissonance operators, or self-appointed internet vigilantes, or undercover media reporters, or goat dancers, and obsessive movement stalkers, of which I have a few, or else just plain lurkers. In other words, the usual great pale blob that just sits and absorbs all the racial information and polemic and exhortation I throw at them like a sponge and remains sitting there silently in a big soggy lump. As has been revealed to be the case regarding Twitter in recent months, many of my erstwhile 1,727 followers were probably bots or other false accounts. Over the past 6 months, it had become obvious that I was laboring under some kind of shadow ban. From what I could determine from others and from certain things I did myself, the overwhelming majority of my ostensible followers were not even seeing my tweets. In any case, for whatever reason, those 1,727 followers were almost entirely dead weight. Plus, I'd been stuck at that number for almost 4 months. Something definitely was going on with that account, and to be honest, I didn't really lose that much. The tweet for which I was ostensibly suspended reads as follows. It is better for white people to die on their feet rather than live on their knees. I seem to be pretty much alone in that opinion. most of you seemed quite comfortable on your knees with no real desire to change anything. Interestingly, when I posted this tweet on Northwest Revolution and also on Gab, a number of our younger audience responded in ways which indicated that they thought it had to do with fellatio. Apparently, the very old expression that it's better to die on one's feet than to live on one's knees hasn't survived into the culture of those born after about 1975, which I suppose isn't too surprising. Some people who are still on Twitter sent me screenshots of a couple of people I never heard of, presumably so-called social justice warriors, who were cackling and laughing and congratulating themselves that they had reported me to Twitter, and in both cases these people posted a response they allegedly claimed that they received from Twitter. According to what these two pigs said that Twitter had sent them, the tweet I just quoted constitutes, quote-unquote, promoting suicide, and I can make no sense of that at all. Of course, the real reason is clear. I was suspended for being Harold Covington. I have to say, I'm amazed that I lasted 2.5 years. Although I did get 2 12-hour stints in Twitter jail a few months ago, there was at one stage some speculation that my account was being left alone by the Jews who run Twitter at the request of one or more secret police agencies so they could spy on me and monitor what I was saying. If that's the case, then they certainly got an earful during that 2.5 years. I have received an indication that there might be another reason my account was suspended, but it has to do with a specific individual who claims to be quote-unquote one of us. My information here is incomplete and might be erroneous or else common or garden variety internet cack, so I won't get into that any further. Contrary to what you hear, I don't spread rumors unless I believe it to be a matter of safety and overriding concern that others be made aware of something. Now, a lot of people have asked me if I'm going to try and sneak back onto Twitter. Well, I don't know, but not anytime soon, and maybe never. I'm going to be honest with you. Those two clowns may actually have done me a favor. And no, I'm not just talking sour grapes or making a virtue out of a necessity here. I had been having some pretty sincere doubts about the whole Twitter experience for some time before I was cut off. Now, don't get me wrong, Twitter was by no means a complete waste of time, and I frankly recommend that if you haven't tried it, you should, just so that you can understand what's going on in our lunatic culture today. Like it or not, it seems to have become America's official town square, the place where everybody goes to see and be seen. Plus, I have to admit that some tweets from people like Donald Trump and James Woods were fascinating to read. I got to heckle the president himself, although I would be amazed to learn that Trump himself ever actually read any of my tweets I posted to him. Nor was Twitter completely useless as a political and propaganda tool. I made some good contacts on there. But as time went by, I noticed a few things about Twitter. Now, the first thing I noticed was that, as I've said, the overwhelming majority of my followers simply sat there like lumps. To this day, I have no idea who most of them were or why they were there. Now, like I said, I had at least 100 to 120 followers who I know in one way or other were bona fide white nationalists and who responded as such. But after a time, I really had to question what Andy calls ROI, the return on investment, that I was getting from these 100-odd guys in return for the time I was spending on Twitter. And that's another thing. I noticed that Twitter was taking up more and more of my time. I freely admit that I am a recovering Usenet addict, although many of you probably don't remember what that was. I understand that electronic addictive behavior can be as bad as chemical addiction. Now, this is one reason I've never gotten into Reddit or the Chans or Tumblr or anything like that. I'm afraid I might get another monkey on my back like I had 20 years ago. During the last months that I was on Twitter, I saw signs that I was becoming hooked again, although not quite as bad as Usenet and with more ROI, nonetheless. Again, I know this sounds like I'm just trying to make excuses or whatever, but it is a fact that even before this happened, I was giving serious consideration to leaving Twitter voluntarily and switching over completely to Gab. And that's where I am now. My Gab account is my old Twitter handle of @HAC1488. Gab didn't make me change the politically incorrect numbers like Twitter did last December. That's @HAC1488 on Gab, and those of you who want a daily HAC fix can get it there. But our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington 98310. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Underban. freedom.
Still is beating heart in manhood's morning noon.